Welcome everybody to this podcast for the Centre for Public Integrity, Australia's leading research and advocacy think tank for anti-corruption in our mighty nation. I'm Quentin Dempster, a journalist. I'm going to be talking to the Honourable Anthony Whealy, the Foundation Chairman of the Centre for Public Integrity, which was established in 2019. It's had some wins and some setbacks. We'll get into them. The purpose of this podcast is to get an idea of the people who are behind the Centre for Public Integrity and what motivates them to join this outfit. And Anthony, welcome to you.
Thank you, Quentin.
Tell me a bit about yourself, your family life, and the things that got you into the law in particular, before we get to your work currently for the Centre for Public Integrity.
Well, I came from a middle-class family from the western suburbs in Sydney. Neither of my parents had very much education. I probably got to what was called in those days intermediate certificate. My father was a bookmaker. My mother left school quite early and did some clerical training, but she never worked much. So I think, like a lot of those people in the 50s, they were obsessed with making sure their children had good education.
Was Dad a licensed bookmaker? He wasn't an SP, was he?
Well, and look, I have to be careful what I say here, Quentin, but he was a licensed bookmaker, but he did have an office down in the Haymarket, which I suspect was used for clandestine SP activities. He did tell me once that he had an arrangement with the local police, and they would ring him and say, Sid, we're going to be raiding your office tomorrow. So we won't have a warrant, but we'll make a lot of noise at the front door, but you don't have to let us in. So that was very nice of them, I thought.
So a great, colourful piece of Australian history, said to be a victimless crime. But yeah. Nevertheless, given your current status, Your Honour, you'd take a dim view of it. Listen, what about siblings?
I had an elder brother, an elder sister, and a younger sister. Two of my siblings were pharmacists. Again, as a result of their good education, that was seen to be a good profession for them to go into. And my younger sister is an accountant and an economist, now retired, of course.
Sorry, go on. You wanted to say something?
I just want to say that that all of us, I think, benefited from those sacrifices my parents made. Sending my brother and I and my elder sister to a boarding school and my younger sister to a very good school in the eastern suburbs as a day pupil. So what we owe them a lot of gratitude. We didn't have any real connections with the law, Quentin, except that a lot of my father's customers at the races, you won't be surprised to know, were solicitors and barristers and judges. And he had a good social relationship with those punters as well. And so as I grew up, there was always this talk about young Anthony. He's pretty good at public speaking and, you know, he's not much good at science or maths, but he's okay with Greek and Latin and all those sort of things. So my path was pretty well predetermined. And these friends of my father's said, well, when he's old enough and gets through his exams, we'll find a place for him in our firms and so on. So I was predestined to be a lawyer from an early stage.
You're well connected through Dad's connections by the sound of it.
But, that's so.
So from high school into university.
Yep.
And which university?
Sydney University, but I got a scholarship, Quentin. I'm not sure we could have afforded me on today's standards to go to university, but in those days...
Mum and Dad put you through a boarding school, you said. Can you tell
they me? Did, but that cost them all their money. And being a bookmaker, one was never too sure whether you'd have a lot of funds the next month or very few funds. So the scholarship was very useful, I can tell you.
Can you tell us which boarding school?
Yes, I went to St. Ignatius College, Riverview.
Right. Did you learn about some Jesuitical... skills from that.
What I learned was the Jesuits were very good teachers and very broad-minded and very individual thinkers. So I wasn't lassoed into Catholic theology of the most dire kind, rather sent out into the world from school as somebody who was able to think for myself and learn for myself to a very large degree.
So St. Ignatius gave you a broader view rather than a narrow
definitely
theological Catholic view.
Undoubtedly.
And so you went to Arts Law at University of Sydney, and you did your articles, and you got your practicing certificate.
Yeah, I became a solicitor in about 1965. I remained a solicitor until 1970 or thereabouts. And in those 5 years, I discovered that I was absolutely hopeless as a solicitor and my future lay elsewhere in the law.
Why were you hopeless? You were self-deprecating. Why were you hopeless?
Well, part of it was just adolescence and immaturity, I think. The other half of it was that I found it uninteresting to be doing 500 conveyances in suburban plots in Bankstown. I mean, a lot of people find that very engrossing, but I didn't. And I think I showed my impatience, and very soon I could see that my future lay as a barrister, not a solicitor.
Did you ever do any acting lessons like a lot of barristers I know?
Well, when I left school, I just successfully portrayed Brutus in Julius Caesar.
I went
down to the Genesian Theatre to start my acting career, and I was told I was too big and clumsy to be anything on the stage except for a policeman. So I gave up.
And was it hard to make the transition to the bar?
No, it was a delight. I mean, I made the transition, and at the end of my first year, I remember walking out into Phillip Street, getting towards Christmas, and I thought to myself, I've never been happier. I've had a great year. I've earned just a little more than I earned as a solicitor, and that was, to me, a success. And the future looked rosy, and indeed it proved to be so.
Did you do defence work, criminal defence?
No, I didn't. As you know, I didn't. I became a judge in the year 2000. I had never done a criminal trial in my life when I became a judge. So I was always working in civil fields, administrative law. I was the king of the liquor licensing and gaming field in Australia. May have something to do with my father's background too. I don't know. So that was the area I specialised in, that much to the chagrin of my peers, who always said, well, you could have done better by going more broadly. But I liked doing that work, and I liked all the people I worked with.
What was the stimulation about licensing law?
Well, it was a kind of microcosm of every sort of litigation. Even though I didn't do any criminal trials, plenty of my clients were often alleged to be unsuitable people, unfit and not fit to hold a license. You know, so there was a sort of criminal element of a kind that you worked in there, where you had to defend your client's interests quite fiercely. There were civil cases on a broader scale involving whether we needed to have more clubs and pubs in the state. But then we had the gambling onslaught of poker machines and the like, and gave you a broad view of whether these things were good or bad or dangerous or not. There was plenty to interest you, but it was a narrow field. I have to concede that my critics were right, and I might have been, I might have been braver in going into other areas of the law, but I didn't. When I took Silk in 1984, I thought, oh, well, this might lead me to be briefed in all these other areas, but it didn't. It just meant that I was briefed more frequently in the area in which I'd practiced for the previous 14 years. And so there it was.
Well, anyway, that's your reputation. The bar was, he's pretty good at this sort of work. And when the work came in, that was what you did.
That's what I did. And I mean, it enabled me to hone what you might call my ideas of strategy and court craft, which are great attributes. And when you become a judge, it's also very useful because you can see other people using them in the courtroom, and you're well able then to handle the delicate situations that arise.
When you become a barrister, you have to have some degree of performance, don't you? Even if you're in before a judge alone. You didn't do any jury work.
No.
In this. It was before a judge alone. So
yeah, I think it's very different. Again, when I was a judge, it gave me the opportunity to see some very famous criminal barristers, see the attributes they had. But I became convinced as a barrister doing the sort of civil work that I was doing, that the best thing would be always to get to the point directly that you wanted to get to, and to always be very clear and be very polite, to eschew too much flair and drama. In fact, you know, I thought that got in the way of a nice logical presentation. So that was the way I hope that I presented myself to the various courts I appeared before, whether it was the Court of Appeal in New South Wales or the High Court, or even in the Licensing Magistrates Court itself, where most of my work took place.
Well, you must have built up a pretty solid reputation if you did your advocacy work in the courts as getting to the point, as you say. And you were appointed to the Supreme Court of New South Wales in 2000. Were you delighted to get a judicial appointment? Was that the way you wanted to go, or could you just stay at the bar?
No, I was delighted. I think that's a fair way of putting it. I did feel the need for a change. You know, I'd been doing the same sort of work for nearly 30 years at a high level. And, you know, that feeling of the adrenaline rush going into court, the need to secure a victory for your client, the pressures of dealing with your opponents, all of that sort of thing becomes quite wearing after a time. So I thought a change of direction that might enable me then to broaden myself out from the areas and into the areas I hadn't practiced in would be good for me in every respect, and so it proved.
As a judge, you get to make rulings not on just on character, the credibility of witnesses. You have to come to a determination about that, but also about the admissibility of evidence. Was that a challenge for you?
Yeah, it was really, because the work I did in the licensing area, the statute said quite clearly that the tribunals dealing with that sort of work were not bound by the rules of evidence. So the first thing I had to do when I became a judge was to learn the rules of evidence. I mean, that was a challenge, but I enjoyed doing that. I must say, Quentin, that I had a lot of help from the other judges that I worked with. They were terrific, particularly in the area of criminal law. And, you know, any success I had, muted though it might be, if viewed objectively, was to a great extent caused by the assistance and help and experience of those other judges around me who were able to guide me in areas where I'd not practiced before. And, you know, I really appreciated their tremendous assistance.
So there was a great deal of collegiality as a judicial officer.
There was. You know, when I became a judge in the year 2000, I remember the judge that I was replacing left on a Friday evening, the same evening that I joined, and I saw him leave the building with his briefcase and nobody said goodbye to him. He wasn't a bad fellow. It was nothing to do with anything personal. It was just that in those times, this idea of collegiality in an institution like the Supreme Court was probably not appreciated as well as it might have been. And so I did set myself out to become the social duties judge, as it were, and I organised from the outset that every Friday night we'd have some drinks on the floor with the other 15 or so judges on my floor, and we'd invite the judges from other floors, and they were a bit reluctant to come at first, but after a few months they'd wander down and everybody would mingle for an hour or so before going home on a Friday evening. And I think that sort of collegiality really made the place more inviting, more productive. It eased the tensions of the week, and it enabled judges to talk to one another about some of the problems they were facing, and all that helped.
So it was quite an insular culture before then, by the sound of it.
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, it wouldn't be as insular as if you were on the High Court of Australia. But I think it'd be quite frosty up there. But no, it was insular, but only to agree, and the ice melted pretty quickly, I'd put it that way.
Sure it did. Is there any cases you can share from your memory, Anthony, that moved you? Because one thing I've noticed covering the courts in my journalism career is that you guys have to be pretty good at writing.
Yes, that's true. Writing judgments was the hardest part of the job. And secondly, writing judgments efficiently and quickly was essential to the job. There were some judges who were very good at doing that, and there are others, unfortunately, who were not. They were in a minority, and I think some of them had problems, maybe a bit of depression, difficulties with coping with their work. So, you know, everybody tried to help in that situation. But the writing of judgments and the doing it efficiently and effectively is the absolute criterion for a successful career as a judge.
And your reputation will be built over time on the clarity of your writing and the logic with which you use to come to the judgments that we ask you to make.
Exactly, Quentin. Yep.
You've served in significant judicial and governmental roles, including on the New South Wales Court of Appeal and chairing the COAG Committee on Counter-Terrorism Laws. What did these experiences teach you about governance, accountability and democracy?
Well, a lot. I mean, I was very fortunate. I mean, this is probably the catalyst for why I'm doing what I'm doing now, in a sense. I had done, as a judge, two of the most difficult terrorism trials that came before the Supreme Court. One of them in particular involved 9 accused. It took nearly 2 years to complete. It had, I always remember walking into the courtroom on the first day, and we had many months of legal argument before we impaneled the jury. But on this first day, when I walked into that very large courtroom and saw it packed with over 40 to 60 Queen's Counsel, solicitors, lawyers and the like, I must say my knees knocked together in terror. But I got through it. And so I learned a lot about the terrorism laws in Australia. That was important. And so then I wrote articles about it. And when I retired at the age of 70, the Commonwealth and state governments asked me to chair this committee to travel around Australia and take submissions about whether the terrorism laws were working and whether they needed improvement, whether there were problems and so on. So as chair of that committee with a very interesting bunch of people, that's what we did. And I think that probably sparked in me my first interest in what I would call the broader issues affecting society. So now I'd finished as a judge. Your role as a judge is essentially to arbitrate the dispute between A and B, or the state in a criminal trial and Mr. A. And you don't get much time to think more broadly about things of this kind. But once I'd retired and once I did that job, which took over a year, and prepared a report and submitted it to the government, which they promptly ignored, I might say, as governments do. I always laughed. It wasn't so funny at the time when they published the report on budget night. I don't think anyone read it. But I was proud of it. And I'd had a lot of dealings with the public. I'd had a lot of dealings with people around Australia that were talking about issues that went to governance and integrity and the like, because those terrorism laws were thought to threaten, in some ways, civil liberties and so on. So, yeah, I was starting to think more broadly by the time that year finished.
Just on counterterrorism, Anthony, what was the, just briefly, what was the major recommendation?
Well, I think that our major recommendation was that we thought most of the laws were okay, that they were effective. Control orders, for example, were somewhat controversial, but we thought that they were effective in keeping an eye on supervising people in the community who might otherwise be dangerous. But we were against the idea of what I would call preventative detention, about detaining people. We thought, really, for rather an unusual reason, Quentin, that is that all the police I talked to said we thought that was a silly thing to do, that you're better off to charge people with a criminal offence rather than just hold them in case they commit one. And I must say that was the view I took too.
So our police officers, who are the first responders, were very well aware and could give you practical.
Yeah. They were. Yeah. And I took a lot of notice of them. I mean, I thought they knew a lot more than the politicians who are out there trying to pass very punitive laws, no doubt to get a few political points up for whatever election was coming up. Whereas the police would say, well, it's just not going to work. We'd rather just police things and do them the way we've always done them.
What did you learn about the use of the media, Anthony, in inciting terrorism, particularly after the Iraq War, for example, the second Iraq War? Mm-hmm. What did you learn? Because with media being so instantaneous and 24-hour news cycle, and the concept of shock jockery, where as a radio shock jock, I can incite a riot almost, as has occurred in New South Wales, and the issue of random terrorism, where people can take a ute and drive into a crowd of people, not only terrorising but making it absolutely impossible for government to protect the community from random players.
Yes, well. It's a big issue, isn't it? And I suppose I would say that, you know, and I did write a few articles about this over the years, with the title "Can We Stop Terrorism?" And that was the issue that arose. It was an issue that changed over time, because the type of terrorism that I was looking at in the criminal trials I did were what I would call conspiracy-type terrorism, that is organised amongst a group of people who were radicalised by, extreme elements within the Muslim religion. And that was one form of terrorism. But as the years rolled on, that changed, and we came to see what I would call, as you've just described, the lone wolf terrorist, who wasn't part of a radicalised a group of 15 or 20 men, but just acting on his own or privately radicalised by what he'd read and studied and so on. Yes, well, coming to the media's role, Quentin, I think, you know, in that year, you know, when I did that report, so that was in 2001, I could see that there was a demonisation of the Muslim community which was being promulgated in certain sections of the media, and unfairly so, I thought. And I thought to myself, and I spoke about this at meetings and in pamphlets and essays I wrote, that we have to get to know the Muslim community, we have to understand them even though they were different, and we have to try and placate their anger because they felt radicalised and demonised by what was happening, and a lot of it was not only happening on the world stage, but happening here in Australia with pushing and shoving from certain elements of the media. And not much has changed, really, Gretton, if we think about today.
No, it's trying to get people to restrain their rhetoric when they're after constituent politicians or media shock jocks trying to get an audience is hard going. It requires a lot of education and counter-terrorism techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering whether the four police at their leadership level, let alone the politicians, are up to the task of trying to change the rhetoric which incites people to random acts of terror.
Doesn't seem so, does it? I mean, we have the director of ASIO saying we want to dial down this sort of rhetoric, and we have it being ignored by politicians, sometimes on both sides, you know.
I fear so. It's a work in progress. Tell me then about your foundation for the Centre for Public Integrity, Anthony.
Yes, well, I think my experience after the events we've been describing was that randomly I was asked to become the head of or the chair of the Transparency International Australia. So that introduced me to broader issues of integrity in public administration that I'd not really confronted before. So this was 3 years of learning, and I enjoyed that experience very much. One issue that dominated was the need for an anti-corruption body at an integrity body at federal level. That took a lot of our time at Transparency International. But Transparency International was also interested in, as the name implies, in some big international issues such as fraud and corruption in the mining industry worldwide. So while I enjoyed learning a bit about that, it wasn't my prime focus, and eventually talking to people such as David Ipp, who was the ICAC commissioner in New South Wales for a while, Tony Fitzgerald in Queensland, and Han Albee, who was our founding person in the Centre for Public Integrity. The idea of a body that would look at corruption and integrity issues in Australia really appealed to me, and I thought it was worthwhile supporting. So initially, David Ipp rang me and Han Albee rang me, and we all had a cup of tea together and said, oh, we'll support this idea. It was just an idea. And then we thought, well, what do you do with an idea like that? And we thought, well, maybe we should incorporate a company. We'll make it a company limited by guarantee. It's, you know, so you just see these things roll on and roll on. And within a year, we had, a company limited by guarantee. We had a board of directors. We had our first meetings. We worked out a very simple agenda. Three things I think we were going to push for in those early years. One of them being the Federal Integrity Agency, getting rid of money in politics, and the third being the protection of our institutions, including the ABC, I might add. So those three notions were at the core of it, and I really thought that's a lot to get on top of. So the idea behind the centre, once it was formed, and once we had the benefit of, say, the GGR status, so we could actually raise funds and issue receipts for people who then would be entitled to a tax deduction. Once we became, as it were, financially able to stand on our own 2 feet, the model that we worked on was really very simple again, and that is terrific research done not by the lawyers so much, but by other people within the organisation, particularly Han Albee and people that they were working with. And the judges would then go out and advocate those ideas as cogently as they could in articles for the newspaper, in interviews and so on. And as you would expect, a lot of our time was spent on fighting a recalcitrant press and a very recalcitrant Liberal Party, National Party, and Scott Morrison in particular, over this issue about whether we should have a national integrity body and what it should look like.
So I'll get to that shortly, Anthony, but the key element of your strategy was that you were going to engage with the media and therefore with the public directly.
Yes.
And we've got the benefit of the digital revolution now with a website which allows you to promulgate all your research papers with engagement with your supporters and the public generally. What did you find yourself, Anthony, about doing interviews by vile journalists like me?
Well, Quentin, I think the first thing I encountered was quite a bit of criticism from my former colleagues, judges of the court, who some of them took a strong view that judges should shut up and not be involved in this sort of endeavour. But I respected that notion, and I think in general it's better not to talk about cases that you've been in unless there's some very, very specific reason for doing so. But this was different. I mean, I thought that on issues of integrity, I couldn't see any reason why former judges who had the ability to get on top of the issues, who would understand the legislation and all its complexities, probably better than a lot of lay people would, were well placed to make commentary. So I just had to wear that criticism, and I still wear it today to some degree. And then dealing with the media then, I was very surprised at how receptive they were to this type of communication. I rarely had a row with any of the people that I spoke to, and I tried to speak as widely as I could. I still do, you know. I always like talking to Kieran Gilbert on Sky News. I probably don't venture near Sky News after dark because I'm a little afraid of what might happen to me in a particular milieu.
I can only encourage you to do that because what you've indicated to me is that if you do reach out to the media in a democracy like Australia, which is meant to have a free media, your voice, even if you're confronted by trolls and critics, your voice will still be there. And at least the Centre for Public Integrity has been able to cut a profile that is quite significant in public debate and discourse.
Yeah, you're right. And I'm not afraid to do that. You know, I'm not afraid to be criticised or to be queried or to be pinned down. And that's okay. That's what it's about, really. But on the other hand, I did find so many of the journalists I dealt with to be really interesting, nice people, and I've benefited from dealing with most of them.
I'm so delighted to hear you say that, because a lot of judges, in my experience, had a very dim view of journalists and media outfits because they're always deeply superficial. They could never get down to the detail that you judicial officers had to, and you lawyers had to in cases. We're always sensationalizing, looking for headlines.
Well, you have to talk to people. That's what judges don't do. That's what the whole point I'm making, that if you come out of your shell and you're interviewed and you're tested on propositions that you're putting and you're able to back them up with good research and sound opinions, well, it's good for everybody.
Absolutely. And reflecting on your tenure as the chair, before we get to the achievements and the bits you're proud of, when did you realise the centre was working and making headway on the public consciousness? It's when you got the National Anti-Corruption Commission idea floated through the federal parliament?
Yes, even before that, we could see that it was working. We could see the advocacy was working because there were opinion polls appearing quite regularly around Australia. A majority of people were supporting the idea of a federal anti-corruption body. If the public were supporting it, that meant we were doing a good job in advocating for it. So what we then had to deal with, of course, was the, you might call the counter-punching from those who didn't want this body organised. And it was quite interesting. I won't go into all the details, but the coalition came forward with a model for an anti-corruption agency that they wanted to put in to practice. It never really got off the ground. It was very flawed. And the more they pushed it and the more we were able to point to the flaws in it, the more the public came to the idea of wanting an effective anti-corruption agency and one that was not designed to protect politicians. And that was the flaw in their model, that it protected politicians beautifully. But everyone else, like the police force, they could be examined and torn apart publicly, but not a politician. So we thought that the more they wanted that, the more I think the public thought it was a ridiculous idea.
And I think it was the Bill Shorten Labor Party which put the National Federal Anti-Corruption Commission on its policy platform, in spite of the fact that a lot of the Labor Party members in that federal caucus hated the idea of a federal anti-corruption commission because of the Eddie Obeid case in New South Wales and the destruction of public support for what was the New South Wales Sussex Street branch of the Labor Party. They lost and huge public support in 2011 when a landslide.
They sure did, and it was very interesting to look at it politically. I'm no politician, Quentin, but I did learn a lot just watching the way that unfolded. Our immediate connection was Mark Dreyfus, and he, I think, genuinely thought that we should have a federal anti-corruption body, but initially he was on his own in that idea. And then we saw, as we went around talking to federal Labor politicians, first of all, I won't name any names, but a number of them were very anti the idea. And so we would have talks with them, and they'd curse and swear about very things that had happened, some of which you've mentioned. And we'd try and point out politely that in the end, it was a good thing to have, corruption out in the open, and better for the community and better for the political parties. And so you could just see the tide turning a bit. And I do remember that it was Bill Shaw in Melbourne one day. We all were down there at a meeting. And Bill Shorten said, to our delight, we are going to support the idea of a federal anti-corruption agency. The Labor Party is going to support it. And then he paused and he said, mind you, this decision has nothing to do with politics. And I thought, well, I suspect it might.
Well, I know it was a great achievement. Sorry to be cynical, Anthony, but when the NACC legislation got through, you and the Centre railed against the very tight constraints on public hearings, because public trust in our institutions is built on seeing the investigative process within the remit of a federal anti-corruption body. And that must have been a very great disappointment to you when you saw that constraint, and then what we now know to be an added layer of scandal through the Robodebt case, where the NACC declined to investigate what we call the Robodebt Six, the six names referred to it by the Catherine Holmes Robodebt Royal Commission.
Yes, well, I suppose, and just with the passage of the legislation first, yes, it was very disappointing. And what was disappointing was that it was totally unexpected. I mean, we'd been involved, as had other, integrity bodies, in earnest discussion with the Attorney General and the Attorney General's department. It had always been part of Labor Party policy that there would be public hearings where the public interest demanded that there should be a public hearing. And we were perfectly happy to have that qualification. That's the right thing to do. You don't want to have public hearings where it's not in the public interest to do so. And you do have to protect reputation so it's not destroyed unfairly. All of those things. It's a very delicate issue, but it had never been suggested in any of our meetings that an extra hobble would be put on the legislation. And that only appeared at the last minute when the legislation was produced to Parliament. And it said, as you know, that you could only have hearings, public hearings, if they were in the public interest and if there were exceptional circumstances. And that was the hobble that none of us expected. And we were very disappointed. And Mark Dreyfus said in answer to criticism and questions, well, you've still got public hearings. We always promised them. But of course, as we've seen, as the months have rolled by, there never has been a public hearing. And I don't think there ever will be under this legislation and under its present leadership, unless, rumour has it that the present commissioner's view is if a person's being investigated, there shouldn't be a public hearing. But if there's some kind of systemic public issue that can be ventilated without pointing the finger at any person, then they'll have a public hearing. But that's not what this legislation should be about.
There is an election coming, Anthony, so you're not going to give up on this point. There can be reform of the National Anti-Corruption Commission legislation to give a wider discretion to the commission to take investigations into persons of interest with appropriate procedural fairness onto the public onto public hearing.
We will keep pushing that issue as hard as we can, and we've got plenty of support with the independents and crossbench on it. And I look also to Victoria. Its legislation was flawed in this way as well. And so they could only have a public hearing if there are exceptional circumstances. But with people like Robert Redlich down there, who was the then commissioner, he held public hearings in a couple of really important cases. So he wasn't going to be cowed by the legislative attempt to hobble the Victorian anti-corruption body, and it did hold public hearings, and they were very effective. I just feel that in Canberra, with our knack, that we're never going to get public hearings under the present leadership.
Just remind me, Anthony, did Redlich allow the live streaming of his hearing?
That I'm not sure of, Quentin. I don't remember whether he did or didn't.
The reason I'm asking that, because in the defamation trial in New South Wales, the big one, the judge Michael Lee one, he did allow live streaming of the hearings and the examination of the witnesses, and thousands of people tuned in. It's quite a phenomenon, really. I know you judges were against cameras in the courts because, particularly in criminal trials where somebody's liberty was at stake. But in broader corruption hearings, that would be a very good initiative, I think, to help engage the public. One of the things I found about the corruption coverage was that people saw that the Corruption Commission was fair dinkum, if I can put it that way, other witnesses would be prepared to come forward to assist. And that really helped to build public trust in the exposure of corruption.
Yes, you're right, Quentin. And I mean, I think that we saw even in New South Wales with its ICAC investigations that parts of those were made public. And that was very effective. And that's one of the reasons for public hearings, as you say, that is to encourage people with information to come forward because it can make an enormous difference to the scope of the investigation.
Okay, what can we learn now? Because the NACC, and we've discussed this in other podcasts, and now it's the Geoffrey Nettle ACKC has determined that there are grounds to inquire. Well, at the moment, as we record this podcast, we're waiting for the appointment of the new robo-debt investigator under the NACC. Is there any possibility that the NACC can be redeemed about this? I'm saying this pathetically because I know you guys have worked so hard to get a federal anti-corruption body established.
Well, that's a very difficult question. I'm very sceptical now because I think under the present leadership, there's been a resistance to the findings by the investigation into the NACC's decision not to investigate, whilst the commissioner has said, okay, we'll accept it and we'll get an independent person to tell us whether there should be an investigation. He's also made it pretty clear that he doesn't really agree that he did anything wrong. And that worries me so much because what he did that was wrong, he calls it, and it's not incorrectly labelled as a mistake. It was a mistake where the investigator of the decision said that there was apparent or ostensible bias. Not actual bias. I mean, that would be terrible if there were actual bias. But what that means, so the public understand it, is that it means that, you know, an ordinary layperson looking at what happened might have a reasonable apprehension that the commissioner might not be able to bring an impartial mind to this decision because of his relationship with a person who's at the heart of the proposed investigation. Now, that's a terrible mistake, if you want to call it a mistake. And I just think that since the work of the NACC is really to confront serious and perhaps criminal conflicts of interest and expose them, if they can't handle a conflict of interest within their own ranks, what is the likelihood of them ever understanding the broader issue when they come to investigate other people's conflicts of interest? So I'm sceptical, really, as to whether they can recover from this. And just in practical terms, who's going to do this investigation? And what powers will they have? And who's going to decide whether there'll be a public hearing? Will that person be lent on by the commissioner to say, oh, I don't like public hearings, let's not have one? I don't know, but the whole situation seems to me to indicate that the NAC under its present leadership is really in danger of not being able to perform the function it should perform.
And therefore, public trust is eroded, even destroyed in this.
It is.
But I've got to ask you, can we start again? Because it's a major setback for the anti-corruption movement, if I can call it that.
We must start again. We must start again, Quentin. We must start again. How we do that? Well, let's see. But we must start again. I think we must change the legislation to make sure these hobbles are not there. I personally, as much as I like Paul Brereton as a fellow judge and as a fellow human being, I think it's not the role for him. I think we need someone else in there. I'd like to put Geoffrey Watson in, of course, but Geoffrey, I think, is not the man for the job either. He's too busy with the CMFEU at the moment. But we need someone who's actually quite prepared to stand up the political class if it's really necessary to do so and not just be acquiescent.
You'd think, Anthony, that the Trumpist experience in the United States, where foreign bribery has been constraints on U.S. corporations involving in foreign bribery have been wiped away. It's
encouraged now.
What is the business case for anti-corruption? Maybe you can get this message over. What is the business case for having a strong anti-corruption culture in our country?
Well, as you've pointed out yourself, Quentin, as we've talked today, the element of trust in our institutions between those institutions and the public is paramount. The business case is the restoration and preservation of that trust, which, as we see in America, surely is dissipated now by these sorts of decisions and so on. So it's a very simple business case that honesty, integrity, transparency and accountability matter in every aspect of our public administration, and that then flows through to every aspect of private and corporate activities. So it's a powerful business case, and it's a very simple one, and we'll come unstuck as a democracy if we don't take steps to restore that trust.
Any other final remarks on the other challenges, apart from the restoration of the effectiveness of a federal anti-corruption commission, for the Centre for Public Integrity? Transparency, political donations, truth in advertising, the whole raft. What's on the plate?
All of them, really, those ones you mentioned. I think we can leave it for another day, but, you know, the recent reforms by the Coalition and the Labor Party to get rid of big money in politics, which, when you look at it, all it did was to get rid of Clive Palmer's big money in politics and also the money supporting the Teal candidates, get rid of that, but leave the big money there for the Labor Party and the Coalition. So we've got to work hard on that one. But it goes further. We've got to look at the way in which we appoint people to important positions. We've got to always look out for pork barrelling or the misuse of public funds, as we like to call it, and the other matters you mentioned. So we've got a full platform of work to do. Plenty of work to do, Quentin.
Well, I'm glad you're still up to it and you're still committed, and thanks for all your courage over the years and your glittering career. Anthony Wheely, thanks very much.
Thank you, Quentin.